Welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'd like to start by acknowledging some good news. This past month, Congress passed legislation reinstating funding to both NASA and the NSF, which, among other things, is great news for everybody who cares about astrophysics research. Right now, I'd like to thank everybody out there who took the time to email their congresspeople, and if you have the time, you should look up how they voted on this bill. And if they voted in favor of it, you might want to send them a thank you note. A thank you to a congressperson is much rarer than a complaint, so they may appreciate it. Okay, so we all know we live in the Milky Way galaxy, but what do we know about its history? How did it form? Why does it have the shape that it has? And how and when did we get our satellite galaxies, the Magellanic Clouds? This turns out to be a very difficult question. It's actually much harder than figuring out the history of the Earth, where we have tree rings, ice cores, and fossil records to tell us about major events over the past billion years. With the galaxy, we just have a snapshot of what it looks like today, so we have to try to turn back the clock to figure out what happened in its history. The most powerful way to map out our galaxy's history is on the computer. We can take everything we know about how matter is presently distributed in our galaxy and where everything is moving, and try to construct a detailed computer model that can build a story of how we got here, reproducing our observations of the matter distribution today. It's a complicated process and requires dealing with a lot of unknown factors. Our guest today, Dr. Gertina Besla, is quite familiar with these techniques and all of their uncertainties and complications. Dr. Besla is someone you might describe as a galactic historian. She develops sophisticated computer models of our galaxy, running them backwards and forwards in time to piece together how the Milky Way got to where it is today. I'm Paul Duffel, and this is the Astrophysics Podcast. So let's get started. So welcome to the Astrophysics Podcast. I'm Paul Duffel, and my guest today is Dr. Gertina Besla, who's a professor of astronomy at the University of Arizona. Dr. Besla, thank you for joining me on my little podcast.
Oh, I'm excited.
So normally, actually, most of the people I have on are, I basically invite my friends on. So I usually know them, and I can sort of say a little bit about how I met, but you came here through Danny Milosavljevic, who has also been on the podcast. Maybe you can tell me how you know him.
It's great. Yeah, so Dan and I were actually undergrads together at the University of Toronto.
And
we, back in 2003, we did an undergraduate project in the same group. We were both locked in the basement doing experiments. It was actually more in instrument design. Stuff that neither one of us do now. But we learned quite a lot about independent work at that time and things maybe we didn't want to do, like being locked in rooms with no windows for the summer.
So. Yeah, well, that's true. When you, especially with undergraduate research projects, the real thing you learn is what you don't want to do a lot of times.
That's right.
So, okay. So then why don't I start off I like to start out, the first part is asking about, you know, how, where you grew up and stuff like, and how you got into science. So let me start by asking, where did you grow up?
Yeah, so I grew up in Mississauga, which is just a suburb of Toronto in Canada.
So you were, so a suburb of Toronto. So what was that like?
It was very quiet. And so I went to school, I went to high school in downtown Toronto, which got a lot more interesting. So being like in the city as a 12 to, you know, 18 year old was pretty cool. but suburb life is quiet. But it was interesting, though, because I'm a child of immigrants.
Okay.
And all the kids I went to school with were also kids of immigrants. And so there was an interesting thing because we came from all over the world.
Yeah.
But we were all born in Canada. And so we had this sort of connection of being able to, having the struggle of having to translate Canadian life with to our parents.
Yes.
And, you know, what we were going through and balancing cultural identity and backgrounds with, you know, our Canadian identity.
I see.
So it was an interesting tie that bound us all together.
Okay. And I guess that's Danny. That's true. His family is from Serbia,
he's Czech, and exactly.
I was just thinking about that. I guess, is that a thing with Toronto? I didn't know about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Everyone's coming from all sorts of backgrounds. So my parents are from India, Punjab.
Mm-hmm.
And my closest friends were from Hungary, from Hong Kong, from Czech Republic, from Egypt, Bangladesh, like all sorts of different places in the world.
And well, that's cool.
It's definitely a kind of combination combination of lots of things that come into one to make an identity.
Well, that's really neat. So now, do you remember, do you have any kind of memory of the first time that you thought you might be interested in doing science, or that you were interested in science, I should say?
Yeah, I don't remember the first time. I think I've always been interested in science. I was kind of interested in everything, really.
Yeah.
I love languages, and I loved art, and but I think I gravitated more in high school towards the sciences just because I was a very curious kid and wanted to understand the way things worked.
Okay. Can you think of like an example of something like that?
Yeah, so I was really, really into archaeology, and particularly Egyptology. I thought ancient Egypt was just fascinating, and the pyramids and their alignment.
Oh, I loved that as a kid too, right?
The, just how precise they were in aligning their huge structures with constellations. And then I think what really got me was when you actually look at the constellations, you don't find them all aligned in the way that they should be with various structures. And the reason for this is because the Earth's axis of rotation wobbles.
Right. So it's not pointed exactly at the same constellations it was millennia ago.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can do with geometry and math and physics, and you can actually discover or realize how to fix that situation so that the skies do align. And I thought that was cool. The fact that you could do that, and that's what, sort of brought me towards
astronomy. So that kind of put you in that direction, thinking about astronomy.
Yeah.
So now you mentioned, you said your parents were immigrants from India.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like there were influences on you in getting into science?
My parents were very, they sort of fit certain stereotypes in some ways of math and science is the most important thing. But they were very encouraging on all levels. I think it was just excel. You need to do well in your studies. And a lot of that was an immigrant mindset, right?
Right.
We've gone through a lot to be here, to put you in through school. And, don't waste it. Don't waste this opportunity. And I think this is what feeds in with a lot of kids of immigrants is pushing yourself to make all the sacrifices that your family has made for you worth it.
Yeah.
And that becomes an interesting challenge when you think about fields like astronomy, which are much more risky when it comes to job security. what you're going to do with a degree in.
Right.
And so a lot of the things that I think about these days is how to build in as many hard skills as we can into an astronomy major. And so many. There's so many different things that we do now in astronomy with, coding and with building instruments and critical thinking.
Right. So so then would you say, so obviously your parents, it sounds like your parents were encouraging you to just generally be interested in, definitely be a good student and that sort of thing. But then maybe astronomy wouldn't be their first choice for you.
No, it absolutely was not. I mean, and again, I think part of it is it's really hard to get your head around what an astronomer is and what your day-to-day is and what your jobs are. And that, I think that's the challenge, which I think is a fair challenge. It's an evolving discipline.
Yeah.
And so what you do with a degree in astronomy has changed quite a lot from what it used to be.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Right. And so I think we're always having this conversation with ourselves as professors now of what are we doing with our degree and major, and how do we prepare students for the reality of the career and job market?
So I guess in practical terms, I guess you're saying for example, nowadays it's a lot more data statistics and things like that, whereas, previously what it would be like.
Well, actually, so it's changed. So much earlier, right, it was a lot easier to get into grad school. So it wasn't even really,
you didn't
have to worry too much about it. But then even about 10, 15 years ago, data science was on the rise.
Yeah.
And so astronomy was at the forefront of that.
Yeah.
It was the origin of data, big data was astronomy.
Yeah.
OSST and discussions of these big survey data sets were what's driving that conversation. But now it's well surpassed, right? It's not astronomy that's leading the big data conversations.
Right.
And now there are data science majors. So why would you hire an astronomer? So that has changed. So I would say it's actually gone. I mean, I think data analysis is still a big one.
Yeah.
Right. But what astronomers in particular bring to the table is coding skills and data analysis skills, but also really big picture thinking.
Yeah.
We deal with problems like what are black holes? What is dark matter? You're not going to, an undergrad that thinks about that for 4 years, and then you throw them here's some technical problem about how to solve this piece of code or debug this.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, it's not dark matter. Like, sure.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. So that's a, not being afraid of a unsolved problem.
Yeah, that's a good way of thinking. Actually, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, that I know, like, I remember 10 years ago, like, a lot of the financial big financial companies were hiring physicists, and I think part of it was because of that, as they thought in terms of these big. They tended to be more people that thought about the whole big picture rather than what was right in front of them.
That's right, and out of the box, and really not afraid to work to try and solve a problem that wasn't like clear cut.
Right.
Right. They know how to, we know how to look up things ourselves, like in textbooks or Google or whatever.
Right.
And are not afraid to sit there for a long time banging your head against the wall.
Because if it doesn't immediately work, you know how to keep going.
And that's a huge, valuable skill. And I think it's going to continually be a valuable skill in the job market. But, you know, it's still the issue of, like, how do we make it clear what, when you see the word astronomy on a resume, how do you actually make that clear what that means and what the skill sets are?
Yeah. So. Okay. Well, so then, okay, so that's...
So we've deviated from the original path.
That's perfectly okay. I wish more of my guests would deviate this far. So originally we were asking about your parents and how that got you into science, or, you know, whether they, you know, what that, you know, that sort of their influence. I guess I'll ask you, because you said, you know, you were generally always interested in science or a little bit in everything. What got you interested in... You said astronomy, like the first inklings were when you were looking at like archaeology in ancient Egypt and how they would have looked at the night sky. But like, when did you start thinking about like becoming an astrophysicist?
Yeah. So in high school, I was better at everything than I was better at like chemistry and you know, art. Uh-huh. And French and Spanish, like just everything versus physics. Physics is my worst subject.
Okay.
But I had I didn't like being not, you know, being bad at something.
Okay.
And I think the other, so there's this issue of like, I'm not bad at this. I'm going to prove it to myself. Oh. I can do this because I liked it. It was the thing about it. It's like, how can I like something so much and be like so bad at it? In terms of, because tests are dumb. You know, the way physics is taught is really counterintuitive. It's really is an application. Like, you need to see how it's applied, not to blocks and pulleys, which are boring. Right, but to something like in space.
It is true, know? And I mean, there's just active research in how we teach physics. But I think like the main thing we've learned over the past like two or three decades of doing all this active research is that we still don't really understand how to teach physics.
That's right.
and
it's not. I mean, I don't have answers here, right? It's really difficult because without the math, it becomes. That's where things start to get really interesting. Is when you can finally do the math that's involved, and you can do more complicated things.
Right.
But that takes a while to get there because the math has to catch up. But there's still more about the applied. I think if there was more of the applied, and in the way that we test, I think the way that we test is just, you know, memorization is not the way to go.
Yeah.
But so I set things up in undergrad. So I was like, well, I'll try it out. You know, and I'll see how it goes. And I just think it's really awesome, and I want to do it. But of course, I set up some, you know, economics classes in case.
Okay, but you were planning on, but your initial plan is I'm going to major in physics and then see if I fail.
Yeah, I did an astronomy physics joint major, and I threw in some econ there as backups.
Okay,
and if that didn't work out, then I would course correct.
Okay. And so that's how you made it. But then I clearly didn't need to course correct. You made it through.
Yeah, and I think again, it's those intro astronomy classes. Like I took an early class, and I was just like, oh, this is just awesome. Like this is just so cool. And then getting involved in research early. And that was really important. Being able to jump into a research project without any prior research experience.
Yeah.
Was critical, and that really set the stage because you got to know a mentor who then was like, oh, you should apply for this other thing that I had no idea about.
Yeah.
And even getting that first experience was actually, it was a class, and I only heard about it because it got flashed in the screen once in class briefly, and I was like, oh, that sounds neat, and I wrote it down. So I happened to be in class that day, happened to write it down, and then therefore my career went forward. And a lot of the work that I do now as a professor, I have this program called Time Step, and our goal is to, at the University of Arizona, to make that barrier to entry easier. right? Okay. So that it's not that you happen to be in class that day and learn about something, or right. that you have to have already been involved in research in yeah. high school in order to be able to do research in college, which is crazy.
Right.
So this program provides, you know, you just apply to the program and you have zero research experience and we yes. train you.
So you're expected to have zero research experience
right.
going in.
Yep.
So that way that way people don't feel like, oh, I'm not ready for this. It's like
yeah.
that if you're not, if you feel like you're not ready for it, then you definitely are.
That's right. That's exactly right. You know, and so then all of a sudden it's like, yes, you don't feel qualified, therefore you qualify, right? So, and the ones who are overqualified are like, you're fine, you don't need us.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, and we, you know, we pair all the undergrads with a graduate student mentor so that they can be there with them throughout the whole program. Mm-hmm. And then they're paired with a faculty mentor, and they're designed is to get hard skills. So it's
right.
focusing on coding or instrumentation. So
okay.
you build lab skills or you build coding skills.
Okay, so the goal isn't like, oh, I want to like, you know, do this research project that will turn into like this great paper or anything like that. It's just learn the basic skills that are used every day by researchers
right.
and get a flavor for what it's like to do
yep.
research.
And beef up your resume. So then you're actually
right.
ready to be able to apply, you know, competitively
oh,
for those positions and for jobs in industry.
Yeah.
So it opens up both doors so that you can get, you know, a paid position.
Oh, yeah. I know when I look at now grad school applications, because now I'm on these committees that look at these mm-hmm. things, I see so many, like now I see all these applications that are so much more qualified than I was
right.
when I applied to grad school. They've like done research, like three different research positions and different institutions. And I like, I would have never made it through this environment. I would
yep.
have no way. Cause I just kind of, you know, I did a little bit, but I did, you know, mostly just kind of was in college and just doing what was in front of me.
Right.
And so, yeah, you really need that. You need to have experiences like that, and if your university doesn't provide that, it puts you at a major disadvantage.
Yeah, and so I'm, you know, and this is what we're doing, and it's working really effectively. We have students who've had no research experience, and then the next mm-hmm. summer they're landing, you know, NSFRU positions.
Oh, that's cool.
Getting research experiences, you know, around the country, and landing industry positions as well. And so it really does start to launch careers, but it's giving students that opportunity. You know, whereas like a lot of folks won't take a risk on a student who has no experience.
Right.
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 So
it's the same story, you know, whether you're out in the job market or if you're doing, it's always like they always need experience.
Well, that's
and how
right.
do you get the experience?
Exactly.
Right? So good. So now you're sort of thinking about your undergrad experience that you got you into it. And then as a grad student, so what sort of stuff did you work on as a grad student?
Yeah, so from my undergraduate experiences, you know, I did like experimental work, I did observational work, I did mm-hmm. theoretical work. And so of those three, I was like, oh, theory is where that's my jam. and it, you know, I really didn't like it having to process data. So mm-hmm. the observational route was just not for me.
Mm-hmm.
But being able to think about the physics and, you know, write equations on the board and think about big ideas was mm-hmm. like, was great. And so I didn't really care what the subject was. As
right.
long as it was that type of work.
Okay.
So in undergrad, I did like, you know, protoplanetary disk environments, so around stars and how planets form.
Mm-hmm.
And then in grad school, I did work on galaxies and dark matter. So very, very different. But
yeah.
again, the tools were the same.
Yeah, yeah.
So, so I studied nearby galaxies that are in orbit around our Milky Way and mm-hmm. Trying to understand how long they've been orbiting around our Milky Way and what have they been doing, how they've been interacting, and what that means for dark matter.
Okay. And so we'll get into, because that's going to
yeah.
be lead into your general research
mm-hmm.
topic that you eventually did, which is usually the case as often as what you do for your PhD ends up being kind of what you end up doing for the rest
right.
of your life.
Right.
Do you think now, maybe I should ask you this, since you actually put a lot of thought into things like this, but when, you know, during that process of in grad school, you know, you're learning basically how to be a scientist,
mm-hmm.
Do you have anything you remember from that you would like, you might tell your past self, like what's a good piece of advice for learning how to be a scientist and when you're in grad school?
So I think that for a lot of grad students, they'll focus in on their classwork
mm-hmm.
and their research, and that's it, and
mm-hmm.
that's the training.
Yeah.
But the reality of the job that they're aiming for as becoming a professor or a scientist, a staff scientist, all those different types of, you know, academic type positions, mm-hmm. our day-to-day is very different from that. You know,
yeah, that's
they
true.
They may teach a little bit, so they do some, you know, they'll TA and they get some training there.
Yeah.
But there's what I really wished I had learned more about was project management.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's, yeah.
Right. And I mean, it goes in with being a scientist.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of things in industry, the way we think about in industry, it's a lot of deliverable sort of thinking where you have some sort of a timeline. You have to manage, you know, what you're going to do to reach that goal.
Yeah.
And there's some aspect of project management that's important there. There's a lot of creative ways of thinking about it. You know, a lot of directors in the arts will have these massive projects, but they have these mental models that they'll develop to try and think about mm-hmm. how to achieve the goal. And I think that could benefit a lot of students to visualize like what they're trying to do, because it's so huge, it's so nebulous. Thesis,
yeah.
Do thesis, right? and it can be overwhelming
yeah.
to have this like huge project that you're undertaking without real deadlines.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of figure out how to manage your time and manage the program and what you're trying to do. So I think there are techniques. Their jobs are project management, right?
Right.
So there's a whole skill set involved with that we simply don't train our students in.
No. And then of course that's right. When you become a faculty, that's your most of your job.
Yeah. It's project management, financial management, team management, emotional management, right?
Yeah.
Like supporting your students and.
Yes.
You know, there's so much of this that I wished I had gotten more training in earlier.
Yeah. And since we don't train people at this, not only are people often not good at it, but also people don't even think about it as being part of their job.
Correct.
And so
they don't value it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the folks that do a lot of that work are also end up doing more of it because there are other folks who don't realize that it's important. So, yeah. I think that aspect of training is important, and we need to do more of it. So one of the things that I strive to do with my students is I show them, for example, the proposals that I write, and I explain to them where their funding is coming from. And this is a really important conversation to understand how taxpayer funding comes in to pay for graduate students. I mean,
yeah.
without that funding support,
You know. As a grad student, I was completely oblivious to that.
That's
I
right.
felt. And I think generally, and I'm guilty of this too, my advisor, I think, probably wanted to kind of shelter me from that, right?
That's right.
Because he didn't want me to feel the burden of like, here's how much like of my money you're spending, you know, with your time, and like, here's how, you know, here's all the work I have to go into to make to keep you on my team.
Right.
Right. There is some extent you don't want people to feel like that pressure.
But at the same time, that sheltering is blocking students from reality. And it's also a sheltering that, you know, if you were to go into industry, you would not have, right? It's the developmental process, I think, is really important. And it disconnects the student from the taxpayer, which I think is also dangerous.
Yeah.
I think we're in a situation where we need to think kind of holistically about what is our role as scientists. And part of that training is to for graduate students is to realize that, yes, you're doing this because you have an innate curiosity that you want to understand and serve. But that curiosity is shared by everyone in the country.
Yeah,
and this is why that funding is coming in through that way. And how the connection between you, graduate student, and the taxpayer is how you're funded.
Right.
Right. We make an argument for this is this really cool science that we want to do. And you've been brought into this process. But we are not an isolated bubble doing this work. We are we are members of a broader community across the U.S. of all citizens who are interested in these questions. And it is partly your responsibility because you are being paid by the taxpayer to do this work and to share this work with everyone around you. And this is why outreach is so important and science communication is so important. Because it is your responsibility. And in some ways, I think we need to turn back to this sort of civil servant model for or create a civil servant model for science, and recognizing that with humility that, you know, it's part of our job.
At the very least, we we can be doing a better job of sort of explaining to people what we do with their taxpayer money and why that's, you know, why they should care, or even if they don't, like, some, not everybody's going to care, but why, you know, why we are interested in it, so that they get a sense of why they might be interested in it.
Right. But for the students themselves to, like, understand that where they're, you know, this is the thing, like, we think we're sheltering them, but I don't think we are.
Yeah.
That's kind of my point. Like, they're still stressed about where their funding is coming from. It's like, they do know that, you know, that there's something is going on and we need to understand if I'm going to get paid. So, like, having them not think about it and not being part of the process is doing them a huge disservice, not only because their stress levels are not going to go away. They just don't know what's going on, which is in some ways worse.
Yeah.
And second of all, you're not training them for what they are going to have to deal with.
Right.
Because they have to understand this whole process in order to then fight for it and utilize it in order to actually carry out their scientific programs down the line.
I do think observers tend to be better at this in terms of, like, sharing that with their students, because they'll often have their students write, like, observing proposals and things like that, whereas theorists often don't.
And that's been one of the things I've been trying to throw in is as much as possible is proposal writing with my students, even though we do theoretical work, because there is, you know, there are theory arms to all the major space telescopes as well.
Yeah.
You know, at least they used to be. So, we write proposals, and that's part of that training process is to give our theoretical students who are doing theoretical work also exposure to how the observational programs are working.
Yeah.
And how you need to write a proposal. So, critical argumentative writing is a class that I teach for graduate students.
I should probably take that class.
Yeah, it's thinking of training that I wish I had, right? So argumentative writing and how to make a case and to get your science across and the importance of it and demonstrate the impact is a critical skill for graduate students. And like you said, you know, most observationally minded students will get some exposure to that through proposal writing, but a lot of theoretical students won't. So once again, you need to equalize that, because how much of our time is spent writing grants and doing argumentative writing? I mean, it's all the time.
Yes.
So that's a major skill set.
At least
set.
It feels like 100% of the time.
Yeah, for real. So that's why providing students, graduate student training in that is, I think, critical. That and you know, so that class is argumentative writing and research ethics.
Yeah. Wow. So, okay. So, and so now let me, now that you're an astrophysicist, let me ask you, what do you like about your job the most?
I love working with the students.
Yeah.
Training students to think critically and to kind of build really big picture ideas is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
My students are incredible. And they take my science in directions that I could not go by myself. Not because I'm writing grants all the time. I don't have the time to do all these things.
Yeah,
but also, I mean, genuinely, they're doing science that I cannot do.
Yeah.
And they're really pushing the field. So watching them grow and that mentorship component of it is amazing. I
feel the same way about my students. I love that. I love when someone comes to me and they just tried something that I didn't think of.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
And launching their careers, you know, watching them go and grow is amazing. So I think that's one of the joys of this job for sure.
Absolutely. Anything you don't like about being an astrophysicist?
I think the level of bureaucracy is insane, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many things that we have to do in this job that, again, was not prepared for.
No.
Right? Having to fight for funding has sort of always been part of it, but I think right now is on another level of insecurity. And again, it's because, you know, it's not about ourselves. It's about our team and the things I love doing, which is to help students.
That's right.
And we pay students through taxpayer dollars, through grants. Without that, I mean, that's threatening the joy of my job.
Yeah.
I don't know how to continue doing this job if I cannot fund graduate students.
Right.
Because that's how I do the science, and that whole mentorship and teaching and watching students grow is the joy.
Yeah.
So I think we're at a difficult point to have that conversation. What do I not like about the job? I think, you know, university structures are broken. I think that everyone sort of knows this, and we do need change. But this way that things are going about it is really has caused a huge amount of stress.
Well, I think what you illustrated about how, you know, a lot of times we don't connect what we're doing to the taxpayer, or thinking about how, you know, there's a broad community that's interested in what we're doing, it really causes the research aspect of what we do at universities to just be kind of ignored by, not even understood by the community. We think of colleges, this is a place where people go to learn, professors teach them, and that's it.
Right.
Whereas most professors don't consider that their job, at least at research universities. They consider the primary reason they were hired is to do research, and so we have this major disconnect in just
that's right.
All right, how the taxpayers see what our job is compared with
that's our fault. I think that's the fault of scientists, because once again, it's like this view of money as being sort of a dirty thing that we don't talk about, you shelter your students from, don't mm-hmm. think about it, just do the science because the science is the most beautiful thing. But the money is a part of an agreement with the taxpayer, right? And so, and right. I think that component has to be part of our, endemic to our job. Like, that is part of our job. It's our part of our responsibility. This part of communication of our science and thinking broader than just our own interests and the university as a siloed entity, right? Those doors need to be open to the community around it and to the rest of the country.
All right. So, okay, you've completely convinced me, but how do we do that?
Well, exactly. I don't have great answers to this. I don't think the answer is more outreach. I think astronomy in particular has done a phenomenal job at outreach. I mean, mm-hmm. the amount of educational materials that have been created through NASA, through NSF, and through DOE, and through all of this, the folks who are doing all this amazing podcasting work, right? There's a lot of these efforts around, but there's something is missing in terms of how it's actually connecting in. How do we get these materials to the people there, or making the desire the other way? Something is missing there, and I don't know what exactly. There's a lot of answers to this. Mm-hmm. I think on the largest scales, the biggest platforms that we have for science communication, there's really only two people doing that work, which is like Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson, and they're doing a lot of great work, but why are there only two?
Yeah.
And that's not something we think about as a field, right? We don't think about who are our spokespeople to in like late night television, you know, that is actually coming into people's homes and having that conversation. We've kind of left that very public sphere. We've stepped away from it as scientists. We don't really, you know, Carl Sagan did a lot of that work.
Yeah.
But at a time when the field was smaller and when you could have a person who could communicate with the scientists. And then you could have a person who was communicating with the public, and there was that sort of exchange, which we don't have now, because as scientists, we don't talk to Neil or to Bill, right? Like, we don't have that challenge.
I haven't talked to Bill Nye in ages.
I know. We used to be such tight friends, and then he got so big. And, you know, I'd love to have those conversations, but, you know, but they have full-time. I mean, I understand. They have full-time jobs. Like, it's a lot of work they're putting in. But that's why there needs to be more. And I think we, as a field, need to find more people. There are so many people who are willing to do this work, who are trying to do this work, creating personas and creating identities that can relate to people. And there's so many different types of people in this country. You need more than two, right? and we need to think about it strategically. Like, it actually has to be part of our strategic mission is to get into people's televisions and talk to them where they're at.
Well, it should really be their phones nowadays.
Exactly. But. Sure. Right. You know, but we need like an actual like social media. I don't know what it is. Right. Like we do so much of this work, but there's something broken in that communication channel.
Right.
And I think we need to spend time as a field to think about what that is. I think that's really the only thing I'm saying.
That's fair. That's fair. I was hoping you had a perfect answer.
Yeah, you know, I hope so.
It,
I would have hoped so too. But I.
That's
but
okay.
I don't.
Identifying a major problem and pointing a spotlight on it.
I mean, that's one. You know, I'm just thinking out loud about things. But you know.
That's fine. That's all I do most of the time. All right. So I could talk about that forever, but I should move us into talking about science. So here's how I always ask the question: when you meet a new grad student or a fellow scientist, and they ask you what you work on, what do you tell them?
Yeah, so I'm interested in the nature of dark matter.
Okay.
This is this unseen material that is everywhere. It makes up the bulk of the mass of our galaxy, and yet we don't know what it is.
Right. So, good. So, before we continue, this is the biggest complaint I get on my podcast. I read all of my negative reviews, and each one hurts me. but they all, most of them say I interrupt the guests too much. But anyway, I want to interrupt you because I wanted to, since I think you're the first guest I've had that talks about dark matter, which is surprising because actually it's kind of one of the biggest, like, outstanding questions in astrophysics, and we haven't really talked much about it. So we should actually get into this explicitly, like, what is dark matter?
Yeah, I mean, that is the question, right?
Right. Right.
So what do we know? We know that it is likely a particle. And my research has been working on trying to make sure to validate that sort of statement. Mm-hmm. It seems like that it actually exists as a particle, or some type of matter should be something we know. But, you know, we also could just be measuring gravity incorrectly, right? Okay. It's always a possibility.
To back up, though.
Yeah.
Just to clarify, dark matter is basically, on a basic level, it's just matter that we can't see.
That's right.
And so that sort of brings up the questions of, like, well, why can't we see it? And if we can't see it, well, the other separate question is, if we can't see it, how do we know it's there?
Right.
So
I mean, exactly. So some of the things that people would say is, like, well, how do we know that anything is there? How do we know that a star is there?
Right,
well, it radiates, right? It emits light in the, you know, or emits radiation in the electromagnetic spectrum, and we can build a detector to see it.
Right.
So one option is that dark matter, you know, doesn't radiate at all. It doesn't interact, and certainly doesn't on any very obvious level, otherwise you would have seen it by now.
Right.
Right. And maybe it could have properties, like, for example, dark matter particles could annihilate and they could release gamma rays. That is a theory that people are trying to consider and prove. The complication with that is that other things emit gamma rays too. So it's really hard to disentangle the signals. But so those are the kinds of things you go through. It's like, okay, well, if it's unseen, what does that mean? It means that it doesn't emit any type of radiation. So we need to come up with a particle that doesn't radiate or doesn't decay
on some
level. But it does
have some kind of, but it obviously it's still, the reason we know it's there is because of gravity.
Right. And if it is able to pull on other objects and make them deviate from their path, means it has gravity. You know, we jump up and we fall down because the Earth pulls us back. And it happens because it has mass.
Right.
So this is a particle that has to have mass. That's what we call it, particle. It has some sort of mass that has a gravitational pull, and there's a lot of it. And that's why the gravitational pull of it is so strong.
Right.
It's why our galaxy doesn't just fly apart, and why there are things that are orbiting around our galaxy at high speeds that are still in orbit around our galaxy.
Right. So to a good approximation, all of this material in our galaxy is basically just orbiting around the dark matter.
Not just around, but within. So the dark matter isn't just centered at the very center of our galaxy. It's spread all throughout it, including well beyond the edge of what we consider the disk, or the edge of where stars are located in our Milky Way.
Right.
Right. So when you look up in the night sky, if you're in a dark skies, you know, you'll be able to see this kind of plane, or like a line on the sky that's like these stars. It's very bright.
Yes.
And that's the Milky Way, and we're inside it. But outside of that Milky Way, there's still dark matter.
Right,
it's just everywhere. And so objects that are in orbit around our Milky Way, so things are moving around our Milky Way, are actually moving through dark matter.
Right.
And that's what my research is actually focused on, is how do galaxies, their stars, move through dark matter? And if it's a particle, then it kind of acts like a boat. So if you have a star that's moving through dark matter, it'd be like a boat moving through water.
Okay.
And it would leave a wake behind it when a boat goes through. And so these wakes actually exist in dark matter. If dark matter is a particle, it will it operates kind of like a fluid, and sort of, but it'll leave trails.
Right.
And so my job and my team's job is modeling those trails and how we might be able to detect them. And so the question is, like, you know, it's dark matter, so you're not going to be able to detect it with a telescope directly, but dark matter has mass, and so it has gravity, and so it's going to pull other objects. And so these wakes are going to pull other objects differently.
So you have, like, say, one massive object that's moving, and it disturbs all the dark matter around it, and leaving a sort of a wake behind of dark matter. We can't see that wake directly.
That's right.
But then we can maybe see how it interacts with the other objects around.
You got it.
Gravitationally, and then use that as evidence for this wake.
Yeah, and if there's a wake, that means that there are particles. Because you can't do that with just saying, oh, you know, Newton's laws are wrong.
Oh, I see. So the point is, so getting back to this what you said earlier was, you know, the reason we know, can tell it's that dark matter is there is because of its gravitational influence. But if you're very cynical, if you're even mildly cynical, you might just say, well, this is, you can just change your law of gravity, and then you don't have to have dark matter. It could just be just a different gravitational law. But that wouldn't predict very specific things like this wake you're talking about.
Wake is very specific to it being a medium, like particles that are there that are responding to an object moving through it, like water would respond to a boat moving through water.
Right.
So that's what. So those are the kinds of questions that my team is looking at, and it's really kind of crazy, right? This kind of research, but it's a lot of fun because the really neat thing about dark matter is because it is not directly observable. That's where theory comes into play, and that's where you can build computer models to try and understand the properties of this unseen material.
Okay, good. So that actually will transition us into this next question, which is, what does that research look like for you?
Yeah. So we use high performance computing. So big clusters of nodes of things, I don't know. it's really big computers to create simulations that try to reproduce the properties of our Milky Way and nearby galaxies. And so particularly my team focuses on two galaxies that are in orbit around our Milky Way. So they move around the Milky Way just like the planets move around the sun. Mm-hmm. And they're called the LMC and SMC. They're seen through, by your naked eye in the southern hemisphere. So it's actually interesting if you go to like Chile or to Australia or any other country in the southern hemisphere, and you go on a dark night, you'll be able to see these two objects that look like clouds in the sky. Mm-hmm. And they're huge. They're much bigger than the moon on the sky. And you can just see them, and they're galaxies. It's really amazing. Right. They're like a normal part of the southern hemisphere, southern skies that we just don't see in the northern hemisphere.
Right.
And so they've been known to humans since there were humans there, and they're part of the mythologies of so many different civilizations in the southern hemisphere.
Right.
Which is incredible to think about that, we're studying the nature, origin, properties of these galaxies that humans have thought about since there were humans here.
Yeah. I always thought in the northern hemisphere we had the North Star, and that was our like thing, but in the southern hemisphere they have the LMC and the SMC that they got to have, which is like,
I know, I'm so jealous. It's like it's incredible to like, you just look up and you're like these huge galaxies that you can just see, and they're just there always. I mean, it's amazing. And so my team creates really detailed simulations of these galaxies. And that's particularly cool right now because we have so much observational data for these galaxies because they're so close to us. They're really not that far away, and you can see them like with your naked eye, right? So put amazing telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope or JWST on it, and you're just going to see so much data.
Yeah.
But they're complicated. They've been... they're interacting with each other. The small one, SMC, just actually smashed straight through the other one, interestingly.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
When you say it just did, that was like...
actually, like 100 million years ago.
About 100 million years ago.
Which is not that long.
No, that's not very long ago.
Right?
But so, you say that, it makes it sound like it did yesterday.
But, in astronomer speak, that is like a blink of an eye. Yes. Because, normally we talk about billions of years timescales. But 100, 150 million years... I mean, life was around on the
Earth
the time when that was happening. So these are new models, right? This is something our team has been developing, that these two galaxies smashed directly with each other. And there's, then they led to a firework display of stars forming, gas being thrown out, and they've done a lot of damage to each other and kind of changed the structure of these galaxies. And so we're very close by to a galactic collision.
So then then does that mean that, you know, when you look at them now, you can see evidence for sort of the aftermath
these? Okay. These two galaxies are really messed up. They're referred to as irregulars because we don't have a good classification for them because they look weird. Uh-huh. The reason they look weird is because they smash through each other. Yeah. But, you know, the reason that they smash through each other is because they have a gravitational pull.
Right.
Which is dark matter.
Right.
So to understand all these amazing observations and to understand this cosmic collision, you need to have a model for dark matter.
Right. So just to clarify then, our galaxy, of course, has this big, what they call a dark matter halo, this big, sort of big gravitational well of dark matter around it. But then each of these little sort of dwarf galaxies, LMC and SMC, also each has their own little bunch of dark matter. I don't know if little relative to maybe the Milky Way.
Well, that's right. And but, every galaxy, to be a galaxy by definition, you need to have this distribution of dark matter around you. It's
right.
What makes that's the difference between a galaxy and just a random cluster of stars.
Mm-hmm.
Each of these galaxies have their own dark matter content, and they're moving through the dark matter of the Milky Way.
Okay.
And leaving trails and wakes behind them.
Okay, I think I can kind of see where this is going. So then if you could look at these two galaxies, these little, now we can see them with the naked eye, but what if we could see the dark matter? Would it look different?
Yeah, and so they're bringing in so much, you know, they're smaller than our Milky Way, but the amount of material they're bringing in dark matter, it's only like a 1:4, 1:5
okay.
ratio.
Oh, okay.
You know, so, or, you know, at best 1:10, it's still a lot of dark matter. And so they're going to start messing up the Milky Way's dark matter.
Okay.
And they're going to start changing. And if you change the way the dark matter is distributed, that's all the mass. The mass is gravity.
Right.
So if you change the way the dark matter is, you're going to change the way the gravity is, the direction of the gravitational pulls. So stars are going to move in different directions than they would if there weren't all this dark matter being brought in by these two galaxies. And so this is another test for dark matter. If we think our models are right, we actually have a fairly good idea of how much dark matter they should be bringing in.
Right.
So you know the strength of these gravitational pulls, and you know where they are, so you mm-hmm. know the direction of the pull. And so then you can look out with new observatories, like with the Vera Rubin Observatory and with Gaia. This is a space mission. And you can actually measure the motions of stars, and you can see which ones are moving in the direction that your models predict.
I see.
And that's our proof that there is a lot of material there, and that's not material you can see, and so that's dark matter.
I see. And is it, because these galaxies collided somewhat recently, is this dark matter centered on the LMC and the SMC, or is it has it offset because of the recent collision?
Yeah, that's a great question. The collision, the dark matter in the LMC is probably more or less centered on the LMC.
Mm-hmm.
The SMC has lost a lot of its dark matter.
Okay.
And it's most of that dark matter is now part of the LMC.
I see. And this is all basically known because we can do these calculations theoretically.
That's right. I mean, this is what my team is saying.
Right.
So, yeah, this is what the models will predict.
Right.
You know, they'll have originally a large amount of dark matter, but as you interact, you bring that dark matter into the larger galaxy. So for the LMC and SMC, the SMC is the smaller of the two, so it's giving its dark matter to the LMC.
I see.
The two galaxies are now around our Milky Way, so they're giving all of their dark matter to our Milky Way. And that's how galaxies grow over time.
And so then the SMC, so it's lost a whole bunch of its dark matter. Is that basically messing up all of its stars? Are they going to get flung out?
So it's if you look at the with Gaia or you can actually measure the motions of individual stars inside this galaxy. It's wild. It's like this data set's amazing. And so if you look at it and you say, okay, which direction are all these stars moving? What you'll find is that stars on one side of the galaxy are moving away from it,
mm-hmm.
and then the other side, they're moving away from it. And so the whole thing looks like it's exploding.
Oh, wow.
It's just stars are going out. There's a core. There's a body in the middle that's still, like, bound.
That's still bound.
Yeah, but outside it, everything's just exploding away from it.
Wow.
And the way you explain that is that it smashed through the...
I see. Wow. Yeah. That's
very
cool.
So the data is backing up the story and is really showing that these are in the midst of galactic transformations. It's about, we think that galaxies change over time through collisions. They'll change how they look. And we're witnessing one in action, like caught right after a collision, which is a really special place to be.
That is very special.
Yeah, I mean,
we were very lucky of us to be able to do that kind of science.
It's a little weird. Yeah, exactly.
So I want to think about these sort of computer simulations. Maybe mm-hmm. you could get a picture of what that looks like when you're doing these calculations on these big supercomputing mm-hmm. facilities. What does that look like?
Yeah. So the NASA actually runs large supercomputing facilities mm-hmm. that are accessible to professors and students all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. You can apply for time on these. Mm-hmm. At the University of Arizona, we're very lucky to have a local supercomputer. So we mm-hmm. actually have computing facilities on campus. And what that allows us to do is to actually run a whole bunch of different tests. So the thing with the National Computing Centers is you kind of need to be able to run like
you have a big project.
You have a big project. It's well defined. It's like this is gonna. I need like super yeah. high res, and that's our computer is not as big as the things at the national facility. So there's a good reason to have those.
Yeah.
But to get to the point where you're ready to run the production version of your simulation, you need to do a whole bunch of tests.
Right.
So to have local resources like we do at the University of Arizona is huge. So mm-hmm. our graduate students can learn and train on these systems. So kind of the way this works is, you know, you will submit, you kind of create some sort of initial condition. So you say, okay, I have a galaxy that is going to be over here. It's mm-hmm. going to have this number of stars, this amount of dark matter.
Right.
And another galaxy over here that has this number of stars and dark matter. And you write this all up into, the code. And it says, okay, we represent stars with particles.
Right.
And then we put it to the computer, and what the computer does, and this is always like kind of scary when we talk to like, oh, you're a theoretical astrophysicist, like, whoa, what do you do? These codes must be so complicated. But really what in the terms of the physics, it's just gravity. It's like, it's Newton's laws of gravity. Like high school students know these equations.
Right.
Like this isn't super complicated. So the point is that what the code does is it computes the force of gravity between, you know, one star particle in this galaxy versus the star particle in another galaxy. But the whole point is that, you know, you can do that calculation by hand,
right?
But there's like billions of particles,
right?
So you're not going to do all of those by hand. That's like, you know,
right, right.
Because it's like
so that each individual task is not a good computer program. Each individual task is not a big complicated thing. It's that the whole point of it being on the computer is that it's this massive complexity of many, many, many calculations,
right?
Of these gravitational forces between every single star, which, like you said, it's the basic physics is something you learn in high school physics, but putting it on, learning how to write it in a way that it can be put on a supercomputer and things like that. That's, of course, there's some complications there.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, exactly.
Yeah.
Right. So there's other things involved, but at its basics, the main problem is that you just can't do all these calculations by hand.
Right.
So the computer does it for you.
Right.
And so that's what we tell the computer to do, is to compute the force of gravity, you know, 10 billion times.
Right, 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 right. You know? And then move the particles all a little bit and then see.
Do it again and again and again, right? And see what happens. And so that's kind of what we use these tools for.
That's very cool. So, and then basically, and then ultimately you do an example model, and then probably the first time you run it, you coded something wrong and you have to restart.
That's right. And this is why, you know, you don't worry too much about wasting precious time that you fought to get, because you're doing the training locally. And
right.
then once we've got to the point where we're like, oh, this is the version, then we'll go to the national facilities
right.
and do a wonderful, beautiful, you know, simulation that we'll then mm-hmm. present to, you know, the world, right?
Right. And then it makes some kind of prediction for, first of all, where the dark matter should be after the collision, and also, like, you can ask about its influence on nearby stars and things like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And then, you know, we're investing a lot of time through, you know, programs like with JWST, and, you know, these, again, are, like, taxpayer-paid, mm-hmm. like, major missions, mm-hmm. and we're getting so much data, and it's incredible. But to really understand advanced fundamental physics, you need theoretical models to
That's
help
right.
you understand what is going on.
That actually, it's a great point. And I think a lot of, you know, because most of JWST funding ends up going to people doing the actual observations.
That's right.
But if you ignore a theory, what happens is we get all these great pictures, and then we can't tell you what we can learn from it.
The hardest questions that I get when I give public talks come from 10-year-olds. And 10-year-olds ask these questions that are, they get to the heart of it right away. And it's usually mm-hmm. why.
Right.
Like, why is this happening? And you know, we're getting further and further along to be able to answer those questions. But to a certain extent, it's going to stall because theoretical funding, funding for theoretical research is dwindling. It's being cut because we need to focus on building the facilities and getting the data. But at some point, like if you want to make the next leap in thought, right, of where are we going to go, you need a new idea. You need a new theoretical model to come out of all of this. And so that's why it's so critical that we also have funding for theory alongside the observations when we build instruments like that, like JWST.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here. Yeah. But
<that's>,
it is. You're preaching to the choir with me, maybe not with it's great to say it for, it's very good to say it to the audience, because my parents like to hear that too. So, so good. Now, can you give me, let me ask you this. Can you give me an example of a recent result that you're excited about or?
So we think we have observational evidence for one of these wakes, mm-hmm. dark matter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, I know, right? So we created these models back in 2019. Mm-hmm. And then we started to work with, we put this idea out there. It's an old idea. If dark matter is a particle, it should create wakes.
Right.
This has to happen.
Yeah.
Right. And so we predicted where the wake should be trailing behind the LMC. So this galaxy that you can see in the southern hemisphere. And this is based on, we know how fast it's moving. We've clocked its speed with HST, with the Hubble Space Telescope. And we know the mm-hmm. direction it's moving on the sky. We have a model for how massive it should be. Mm-hmm. And then you can predict what the wake would look like.
Yeah.
So my graduate student, Nico Garavito Camargo, created amazing simulations and made these predictions. And then we started collaborating with observational teams to try and look for these signals. And so there are multiple teams now that have been looking at stars in, the region of the sky where we think the wake should be. And they're like, there seems to be more stars over here. And they're overall, the properties are matching kind of what we predicted.
Wow.
There's more work to be done, to prove for sure that that's what's going on, because there's a lot of stuff out there and there's a lot of things that could mask the signal. But already it's tantalizing. And there's other predictions involved with this. Like I said, if there's a wake there and if the LMC is as massive as we say it is, it's bringing in dark matter, it should start to pull on other objects. And then there are teams out in the UK that have been looking at the properties of other streams of stars that are in orbit around our Milky Way. And some of these streams have weird kinks in them. Their speeds are pointed in a different direction than you would expect. And if you put the LMC with as much dark matter as we say that there is there, the kinks make sense.
Oh.
It's like the LMC is actually pushing it this way, and that's why it's moving in that direction. And without it, we'd have to come up with some bizarro model of gravity in order to explain why the properties are that way. So I think the astrometric, so this is the word is astrometry, it's how we measure very precise velocities of stars.
Mm-hmm.
This is a crazy new data set. We're going to be able to measure the exact position and direction of motion of individual stars in orbit around our Milky Way. It's really wild. And we're enabled to test dark matter in ways that we simply couldn't have done, a few years ago. So this is what I'm excited about right now.
That's great. And it's also, I know, as a theorist, most of the time, especially in astrophysics, most of the time you end up sort of, you're chasing after the observations and trying to explain existing observations. So when you can make a prediction that then later gets confirmed by an observation, it's a very gratifying thing.
Absolutely. If you think about some of the other big discoveries that have happened of late, the Event Horizon Telescope is one that comes to mind, which mm-hmm. has like created images of material swirling around supermassive black holes mm-hmm. in the center of galaxies. Right, but the motivation to create this program, the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration, was built around Einstein's theories of gravity,
right?
And general relativity. And these were theories that were put forth well before there were any effort, any possibility of being able to test them.
Right.
And then many years later, the facilities were created. LIGO is another example, gravitational waves, once again predicted so long ago and only now being able to be tested. So this sort of like high risk theory space where you're creating models that have specific predictions that may not be able to be tested right now,
right,
but could in 30 years. That's critical to develop,
yes,
right?
Yes.
But once again, like, where's the, we, I think as a field, need to be really thinking about how we put resources to make sure that kind of high risk thinking space is being protected.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's that sounds great to me. okay, great. So maybe we're I think I'm probably running low on time. So then why don't I ask you this one more question, which is, in your opinion, why should we care about astrophysics?
So I think I always go back to the 10-year-old. Mm-hmm. You know, when I give public talks, it's how I remind myself why I do what I do. And it really is, the kids in the audience are just so engaged. And they are thinking so deeply about such big questions. And that, I think, is the importance of astronomy and astrophysics. It gets people thinking about questions that are much, much bigger than ourselves, in a way that gets them excited about math and physics and all these other things that we want them to be excited about. But this is genuine. It comes so early, these kinds of questions about where did we come from? Where how was the Earth formed? What is the sun, right? Mm-hmm. There are things that touch all of us and it unites everyone. It's not like you need some special, you know, observatory or special, like, you know, laboratory to be able to engage with concepts like the moon, tides, mm-hmm. you know, astronomy touches everyone and it has affected civilization since there were humans on the planet. So I think that that is the biggest to me, like, you know, that is the reason why we do what we do.
Okay, great answer. all right. So why don't I finish up by asking what's next that you're excited about in the future? In astrophysics.
In astrophysics, I mean...
Or in your field, if
yeah,
you want.
Yeah. So, you know, the Vera Rubin Observatory, LSST, this is a huge survey that's going to be monitoring stars and objects in orbit around our Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just going to generate a ridiculous amount of data. And I'm really excited about the things we can do with that data set. I'm excited about the theoretical models that'll come out, you know, from my team and from others about how we will then, you know, push and advance that field. So there's just new data coming. There's new directions of things to do. And I think in particular, I'm excited about the creativity that we can bring to this space. I think that we can come up with new ways of thinking about all of these data sets. And I'm excited about building spaces where people aren't beholden to old ideas and can actually come up with new things.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Besla, for joining us. I had a lot of fun talking science with you, and I hope you'll join me again sometime.
I hope so, too. Thanks.
Very nice talking with Dr. Besla about her research. Later on that day, she gave a much more technical astrophysics seminar at Purdue, and it was amazing to hear about how much we've learned just over the past decade about the history of our own galaxy. So thank you once again to Dr. Besla, and thank you to our listeners. We will see you next time. Music on the Astrophysics Podcast was written and recorded by Britton Ashford. You can find it on her album, Trotter. All songs were used with permission from the artist and producer. Look her up if you enjoyed the music. This podcast is produced in beautiful Lafayette, Indiana, by me, Paul Duffel, professor of physics and astronomy at Purdue University.